I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Native American women experience violence at higher rates than any other group, but survivors are less likely to receive needed services. Today, a professor of women and gender studies, who's also a citizen of a Creek Nation, says it's time to start paying attention. With two Native women in the U.S. Congress, the invisibility around Indigenous women is lifting, and the issues they face need to be brought to the forefront of activism and feminism. Then, sharks have the reputation as bloodthirsty predators, but they're more threatened by humans than we are by them. Learn more about the social lives of these animals and how they maintain the health and balance of the world's oceans as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Even today, Native American women are invisible, so says our guest for our first segment today, Sarah Deer, who also points to another pivotal issue facing Native women, and that is their ongoing distinction as suffering from the highest rates of violence in the nation. Now, a conversation about the plight of Native women and why it never seems to change. Sarah Deer is a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at KU and a former MacArthur Genius Fellow. She's a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation and has worked to end violence against women for 25 years. Her latest book, The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. And we offer our congratulations because just last month, Sarah was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame, along with Sonia Sotomayor, Jane Fonda, and Angela Davis. And Sarah, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why do you say that Native women are invisible?
Well, we simply don't see Native women in curriculum for particularly K through 12 students. If Native issues are covered, they're usually covering issues that happened prior to the year 1900, and they're probably almost always looking at actions of men. And so Native women do not enter the conversation in our education system. And then we have stereotypes, we have Halloween costumes, we have Pocahontas. There are so many different reasons why even when Native women are in the mainstream of pop culture, we're portrayed in very inaccurate ways.
I was going to say, are they invisible outside of textbooks and classrooms? And you're saying yes to that.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you see signs of improvement?
I think so. I am very excited about the efforts in the past few years to raise the profile of Native women. We now have two Native women in Congress. We have a Native woman in Minnesota, the first elected lieutenant governor of a state. And so we're starting to be more well-known. And in fact, my fellow tribal member, Joy Harjo, was just named the first Native poet laureate of the United States. So it's an amazing time to be a Native woman.
What was the reaction here locally when Sharice Davids won election to Congress last year?
Well, I was excited to my grandfather was the first Native person to serve in the Kansas House. And so I was very excited when Sharice won that seat. But more importantly, I think she inspires young Native women from across the nation, not just here in Kansas.
How long have Native women been dealing with this aura of invisibility you describe?
Well, I think from the get-go. I mean, the whole point of a settler colonial state is the erasure of Native ownership, of Native identity. And so it's sort of built into manifest destiny, really, that we're supposed to disappear. Native men are perhaps more commonly seen in our culture because they have the sort of stereotype of being a warrior. But Native women, we don't see ourselves portrayed in the real world in ways that are inspiring or empowering.
I was going to say, how has this affected you in your professional career as you've gone along?
Well, one of the things that I work on is, as you mentioned, violent crime on Indian reservations. And oftentimes if I present to, a largely non-Native audience, people are like, wait, tribes have their own court systems. They have their own laws. I mean, the ignorance, and it's not necessarily, sinister ignorance, but just ignorance in general about the sovereign status of tribal nations in the United States.
I was going to say, what else contributes to this invisibility? What's in our culture that's driving this?
Well, again, it's the erasure of our identities. If we're still here, then we have to, as a nation, confront the ugly truth of what has happened. So it's more convenient in many ways for us to just simply fade into the sunset.
What's the impact on Native women?
Native women suffer the highest rates of violence in the United States and perhaps in, you know, are up in the world. According to the Department of Justice, over 84% of Native women will be victims of violence.
I saw that stat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And does the invisibility contribute to that violence?
Well, I think if we look at the failures of the legal system to respond appropriately, I think that's an outgrowth of the sort of invisibility. Is if a crime is happening to somebody who's invisible, why would we go interfere with it? Why would we intercede and protect her?
I'm wondering how these women deal with this high rates of violence, not to mention the invisibility. What do they do to counter it?
Well, Native women are really turning back to their own cultures. We have incredibly powerful and beautiful ceremonies, and we have Native women who are doctors and lawyers and musicians and chemists. And it's really about tapping into that that sense of pride about we're still here. Right. We're still here and we're making a difference, not just for Native women, but for all of us.
This turning back to ritual, is that something that's relatively new? Are we seeing that more often in recent years?
I think we're seeing it more visibly. I think Native people generally have not just given up tradition altogether. But more recently, you know, Native women are appearing in the public eye, often wearing ribbon skirts, which is sort of the rallying image for Native women's activism in the 21st century. Just making that visibility, standing up in Congress, standing up outside the Supreme Court and saying we're still here and we want to improve our lives.
How about help from outside tribes themselves? Is the outside world recognizing this issue and expressing willingness to help?
I think so. I think we've seen, particularly around the Federal Violence Against Women Act, there has been a rallying of just in general activists to end violence against women, of them stepping up and saying, you know, we need to make changes for Native women too. We can't forget them. And I think that, you know, when you think about the high rate of violence, 84% of us will be victims. You know, if we can solve that problem, we can solve the problem of violence against women anywhere.
I mean, 84% is simply a staggering number.
It's unacceptable.
Yeah. The fact that the federal government is dealing with the Violence Against Women Act, does that law affect women who live on reservations?
Absolutely. There are special provisions starting in the reauthorization back in 2000, there were new provisions added to VAWA to help better support the lives of Native women. And the reauthorization in 2013, which is the most recent reauthorization, restored tribal authority over certain crimes that had been stripped from them.
Sarah Deer is my guest. She's a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies over at KU. Give me some perspective here, Sarah. How much higher is the rate of violence against Native women compared, you know, let's say, to the rate of violence against white or African American or Latino women? What do you see?
Well, depending on the study that you read, but I focus primarily on studies released by the Department of Justice, Native women are 2 to 3 times more likely to be victims of violence than any other race. And in some counties in the United States, the murder rate of Native women is 10 times the national average.
To what extent are different tribes and the different reservations dealing with this 84% statistic? 84% of Native women will experience violence at some point in their lives. What else is happening in a proactive way here?
Wonderful things are happening. So tribal nations, which have court systems and which have systems of justice and have police departments just like any other government, are starting to improve the laws to address gendered violence in particular. And I think that, you know, in some ways, tribes are sort of their own version of what we might call laboratories of democracy. We're sovereign, so we can create systems that maybe don't mimic the problems in the state and federal systems that we see for victims of gender violence. So I'm excited to see the potentiality of what tribal nations can do to change the way we think about prosecuting.
So given where we stand right now, this is not an entirely dark picture. You're seeing sunlight on the horizon here.
I absolutely am. And that's why, you know, people wonder if my work is depressing or demoralizing. I actually feel inspired by my work. I believe that we're going to make a difference and that we're going to see changes happen for Native women.
I'm wondering how long the rate of violence against Native women has ranked as the highest among these different demographic groups.
Well, the first data that came out to support this finding was back in 1999. So it's been 20 years since we've known officially. Now, Native people have described for centuries the violence that's happened, but we didn't really have any data until about 20 years ago.
You know, your point, just to underscore here, has been that the instinct of the mainstream culture has been to marginalize, patronize, pity, idolize Native women. Am I seeing that correctly?
Absolutely. It's all dehumanizing. Whether it's, you know, whether it's a stereotype that's negative, like, you know, all Native women are drug addicts, or whether it's a positive image, like all Native women are one with nature, or something, you know, along those lines. It's all harmful. We're people. We're humans. We just want to be treated as such.
We're talking about the plight of Native women in this country and the invisibility that they have to deal with day after day. You know, you point out, Sarah, that the instinct, the title of your talk tonight is Sovereignty of the Soul, Centering the Voices of Native Women. Let's take this one phrase at a time. What do you mean by sovereignty?
Well, I think about sovereignty in two different ways, but I'm a lawyer, so I typically think about it in the legal context, right? So I think about the ability of a government to just make laws and be governed by them. And we take that for granted when it comes to states, right? We don't worry about the sovereignty of Kansas or the sovereignty of Missouri. But sovereignty of tribal nations has been under attack for, frankly, hundreds of years. And so we have to try to rebuild and reclaim that ability to act as a sovereign. But I add this word soul not to connote a particular spiritual or religious perspective, but to say we also as humans should have sovereignty over our own bodies to decide what happens to them. And when you're sexually assaulted, somebody else has made that decision for you. And so I think about sovereignty just not just in the governmental sense, but also in the personal sense as well.
You know, part of the title of your talk is Centering the Voices of Native Women. What does that mean?
Well, I often educate college students, mainstream audiences about women's issues, Native women's issues. I worry, though, that they're treated sort of as an extra issue or an outlier issue. And I think that if, again, you know, sort of thinking about how do we solve violence in this country, if we put Native women at the center of that discussion and we can resolve an issue of 80%, then we can do amazing things with rape generally in this country. So if we put women at the center, Native women at the center, we're going to find solutions to problems for everyone.
I'm wondering, going back to Charisse David's success at the ballot box and election of other Native women, does this success translate into progress for the average Native woman? You're sort of suggesting the answer to that has been yes, right?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, both Representatives Davids, as well as the other Native woman who was elected out of New Mexico, Deb Holland, are sponsoring numerous bills in Congress right now as we speak that will attempt to address sexual violence.
And that you think that'll be successful?
I have positive hopes about that.
You know, a broad question here, Sarah. What can Native women teach us? What should we be open to hearing from them?
I think that Native women can offer a counter narrative to sort of the assumption that tribal nations are invisible, disappearing, or shouldn't be around anymore. So Native women can teach us how to operate in a more just world. We have ceremonies that tell us what a violence-free world would look like. And if we're brought into these conversations and centered in these conversations, we can bring some of those ideas and some of that history to light.
The plight of Native women is our topic. Sarah Deer is my guest. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What is happening at the grassroots level among Native women, and what are you seeing out there?
Well, the latest issue that you see a lot is the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. So there's very high rates of homicide, but there's also very high rates of just disappearances where Native women, you know, their families report that they've just gone missing, whether they've left of their own accord or been taken against their will. The concern is that those cases aren't taken very seriously. And so the missing cases...
By whom?
By law enforcement, mm-hmm. in many cases. And so what I see in the grassroots movement right now is families of these women coming forward at the state and local and national level to push for change, to ask that law enforcement take these cases more seriously than they do now.
Is law enforcement getting that message?
I think in many areas it is making it, you know, nobody wants to be a police officer and say we're not looking for somebody who's missing. I think the challenge has been that many of the Native women who do go missing, you know, may have addiction issues, may have a history of homelessness, mm-hmm. and that becomes sort of an excuse, right? Well, she's obviously just off on a bender, but, you know, that's the reason a predator is going to target her.
You hear the same thing from police when it comes to prostitutes. There always are certain populations that are easily overlooked, even in cases of missing women or the potential of homicide.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this extends into Canada, too, doesn't it? This notion of missing Native women.
Absolutely. So that work being done in Canada is interesting because they've been doing it for about 20 years now. I don't know why we came to the conversation later, but there is a very similar history, of course, in Canada of the treatment of Indigenous peoples. And so it's not surprising to me that we have the same crisis here that they have there.
Tell us about the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act that you're working on. You've been down this road before, Sarah, in terms of reauthorizing it. Why is that legislation so vital, and what are its prospects?
There are two main reasons that the Violence Against Women Act is critical for Native women. The first is funding. And since 1994, when the act was first passed, Native women have been able to get federal dollars to set up battered women's shelters and start rape crisis hotlines on reservations. That money didn't exist before. But the other thing about VAWA is that it's changing or restoring the power of tribal nations to take action when the crime happens on their own lands. And that is an incredible change because...
How is it changing it?
Well, right now, tribal nations can't prosecute non-Indians. So even if a non-Indian comes onto the reservation, commits a violent crime, the tribe is not allowed to prosecute that person. And that's a reason.
What's the genesis of that?
Well, it's a 1978 U.S. Supreme Court decision. Hmm. And so not that long ago. It's not 1878, it's 1978. And the court said because tribes are dependent on the United States, they've lost certain attributes of sovereignty, and one of those is the ability to prosecute non-Indians. So we're fighting to get that restored, that jurisdiction restored to tribal nations.
That's an astonishing ruling, at least what little I know about it, but that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I tend to agree with you.
Homicide.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. I think that it was actually just Chief Justice Rehnquist that wrote the decision in 1978, and he I don't think he understood what was at stake.
Sarah, if you put those headphones on, I'm going to grab a phone call here. We're visiting with Sarah Deer, a professor over at KU, about the plight of Native women in this country. Let's go to some phone calls here. And John from Lenexa. John, you're on the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I was just curious in response to the question about or the comment about positive stereotypes for women being negative. In the case of Kateri Tekulwitha, would the veneration of a saint be considered a negative thing in response to your comment?
The sainthood of the Native woman, I can't remember her name.
Kateri Tekulwitha? Yep.
Well, I think there's going to be mixed reviews on that. You know, well, not all Native people feel the same about all the issues. Some people would find it an issue of visibility and a sense of pride. And I think other people would say, well, I don't know if, you know, being raised to that level in the Christian or colonizer's religion is something that we really want to celebrate. So I would say there's not a consistent or uniform sort of framework for thinking about that.
You know, you just were inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame along with Jane Fonda, Sonia Sotomayor, and Angela Davis. That's awfully good company. What was the ceremony like, and where was it? And tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was the ceremony was in Seneca Falls, where the first.
I was going to say, right. Why Seneca Falls?
Right. Yeah. Seneca Falls was the home of the 1848 women's rights event, where they brought forth We the People. I'm sorry. All men and women are created equal. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was there. And it was really the first modern feminist event. And so it was really over the top. The event took place in a casino just outside Seneca Falls, and there was a lot of pomp and circumstance. I felt more like a girl from the prairie than I had in a long time, sitting between, you know, alphabetically Angela Davis and Jane Fonda, who did most of their work long before I was born. So it was a bit overwhelming, intimidating, but very humbling as well.
I was going to say, absolutely. And I should point out that Sarah Deer will speak at 7:30 tonight on the importance of hearing the voices of Native women. This will take place at the Commons in Spooner Hall on the KU campus in Lawrence. The event is free. It's open to the public. More information at thecommons.ku.edu. Sarah Deer, congratulations again. Thanks for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
After a short break, we're going to come back and talk about sharks and this idea that humans are killing 100 million of them a year, while sharks are killing just 4 humans in any given year. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. My thoughts about our show's topics don't end when the on-air conversation's over. For more insight into that, subscribe to my newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, at kcur.org/Kraske. It drops every Monday. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Thursday on Up to Date, a Kansas author traveled rural America investigating what some large corporations want to keep hidden. She says a common weed killer is destroying our environment and our bodies. More on that Thursday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, here's a fact that may not make much sense at first. Humans killed, get this folks, 100 million sharks last year, while sharks killed but 4 humans anywhere on the planet. Given all the hype around sharks these days, you'd think the numbers would be just the opposite. And in fact, it may be time to reconsider the plight of great white sharks and every other type of shark as well. Author and shark advocate William McKeever insists that sharks today are under the greatest threat in their entire 450 million year history. That's despite a glaring fact, which is that they play an essential role in maintaining the delicate balance of the marine ecosystem. William McKeever is the author of Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. He's the founder of Safeguard of the Seas, which is dedicated to ocean conservation and safeguarding sharks. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York City. William, good morning. It's nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, you were working on Wall Street, of all places, when you happened upon a shark tournament that changed your life's focus. First, what is a shark tournament, and what did you see that day?
Yes. So, you know, I was working in Manhattan, and I, like a lot of people, go to the beach over on Eastern Long Island in the summer. And I was in a city called Montauk, and they hold these shark tournaments, and I stumbled into one on by accident. And what happens in a shark tournament is that the fishermen go out with a goal to catch the biggest shark. And they bring it back to the dock, and they weigh it, and if you've got the biggest one, you win the award. Now, these fishermen want to jazz up the event, so they turn it into a gambling operation. And what they'll do is each boat will put in anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000, and they get a big pot. And so the winners are able to split that pot. Well, as you can imagine, when you've got 60-100 boats going out, these pots can get up to $500,000, $1 million. And some of the fishermen that I talked to in these tournaments walked away in one weekend with anywhere from $90,000 to $150,000. And what happens to the shark, though, is not so much fun. They end up in a landfill in Long Island. Hmm. And when I was at this tournament and I saw these sharks hung up on the yardarm as if they were criminals that were to be executed for some crime, it really tugged at my heartstrings. And just to see these magnificent animals die really for entertainment. It's the Roman Colosseum all over again. So that got me so energized, and I wanted to find more about the sharks and about the tournaments, and it led me on ultimately became a two-year journey, totally unexpected.
You know, I was struck by the stats here that I cited when I opened this segment. Humans killing 100 million sharks a year, and yet sharks around the world kill just 4 humans. How are humans managing to kill 100 million sharks a year?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Steve. And obviously, as you know, around the world, there are fishing fleets hunting, taking from the ocean tuna, swordfish, marlin. And when they are fishing, they employ these methods that really suck up so many animals in the ocean, particularly with a technique called longline fishing. And in longline fishing, the boat will put out one single line that can be as long as 100 miles. Mm. And on that line are baited hooks. And so they'll leave that line for a day or two, and they'll come back to it. And, of course, they have all these sharks that are attracted to the bait, of course, along with the tuna. Now, of course, they want the tuna. And when it comes to the sharks, while people usually don't eat shark meat in the United States, so they eat them in other countries, what they do is they will fin the sharks and then sell the fins to the Chinese, and as well as other Asian countries.
And the rest of the shark just goes to waste.
And the rest of the shark goes to waste. It's an utter travesty that takes place. And I would add, and this is what was very disturbing to me, is that they'll fin the shark while it's alive, and then they'll throw it overboard. Well, a shark without its fins can't swim. And many species of sharks need to swim to get the oxygen over their gills. So they'll end up at the bottom of the ocean and literally suffocate to death. It's a horrible, painful death. And of course, obviously wasteful. The fins are less than approximately 5% of the shark's body weight. So all that meat is a horrible travesty taking place on the high seas.
So naive question: you can catch a big great white shark using just a hook, a baited hook?
Yes, you can. And in fact, in the United States, it's that easy. And so what the government did was they said, if you catch one, you have to let it go. We're not going to let you kill it. Otherwise, there would be, great whites are enough trouble. So that at least we put that rule in place in this country.
So with humans killing 100 million sharks a year, I just got to ask, how endangered are sharks then?
Well, there's some species that step back. There are 500 species of sharks. They've been around 450 million years. So through evolution, they have changed and morphed. Many of them are very small. And it's only a handful of very large sharks that we know about, the tiger, the great white. So if you look across the spectrum, as I mentioned, some are in serious trouble. The whale shark, for example, they get to 35 feet. They're on the endangered list. The same thing is true for the mako shark in the Northeast Atlantic. They've been overfished. In the Pacific Ocean, the oceanic white-tip shark, their populations are down 80 to 90%. Hmm. So a lot of them are in serious trouble. Now, there are some that are holding up reasonably well, like the blue shark. But overall, this is a species that cannot keep on being hammered like this because, you know, they're like us. They breed once in a while when they have their pups. They'll have maybe some species, like a great white shark, mainly only 2 or 3. It's for some, maybe it's 5 or 6. And so when you're killing these animals at this rate, they can't reproduce like fish do. Fish, a cod, will lay a million eggs or hundreds of thousands of eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can somewhat recover. But that's not the case for a shark.
William McKeever is my guest. His new book, Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. William will be speaking about his book and show a 20-minute preview of his new documentary by the same name. It'll be at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening at the Linda Hall Library, 5109 Cherry Street. That's in the midst of the UMKC campus. More information at rainydaybooks.com. This essential role they play, I mentioned, in maintaining the delicate balance of the marine ecosystem, William, to what extent is that endangered given this mass slaughter of sharks around the world?
Yes, it's a serious issue, Steve, for the world's oceans. And perhaps the best way for your listeners to understand this concept of sharks as being crucial to the oceans is to step back and look at terrestrial creatures, particularly Yellowstone. Now, just a quick summary, you may remember wolves were removed by design mm-hmm. from Yellowstone. So by the 40s, they were all gone. And what happened to Yellowstone was that ecosystem virtually fell apart. Many species of other animals died off. The rivers started to meander more. The bark was in bad shape. And so they decided to bring the wolves back. And they brought them in from Canada. And there was practically an instant reversal. Yellowstone recovered. There was now more shrubbery because there weren't so many elk grazing. With the river banks in better shape, the rivers actually flowed straighter. Hmm. The beaver population came back. So they built ponds, which brought back eagles, which brought back other animals. And that's just a simple example on land. Now, when we go into the ocean, sharks are just like wolves. Hmm. They're apex predators. Mm-hmm. They sit at the very top. So to give you a concrete example, so you may be a diver, Steve, or a snorkeler, and if you go to a reef, you'll see many creatures. They each have their own role.
Mm-hmm.
And a parrotfish, for example, will go out on the reef, and they'll chip away at the reef, and they're eating the algae. Now, if the parrotfish aren't there, the algae will explode, cover the reef, and smother it, and that reef will die.
Mm-hmm.
So in Australia, where they found an area where the reef had died, and all the sharks had been removed. They were overfished. And the way that it works is that without the sharks, other mid-level predators, in this case, groupers and other species of that size, went on a field day, and they ate all the parrotfish.
Hmm.
So when the parrotfish were gone, the algae grew on the reef and killed it. So those sharks, when they were there, they were keeping the grouper population and other middle-level predators in check. In summary, the sharks make sure that there's no one species of fish that monopolizes the resources
yeah,
of a reef.
That's interesting.
And so we need sharks desperately. You take them out of the ocean, we're going to cause havoc that is going to last for who knows how long it would take to recover, even if we could bring the sharks back. And, you know, I get all excited about this. I apologize. But, you know, there are people around the world that rely on fishing, not just for their job, but for their food to survive. We are playing Russian roulette with the oceans when it comes to sharks.
William McKeever is my guest. We're talking about sharks and why we need them. He speaks again tomorrow evening at Linda Hall Library. More information, rainydaybooks.com. If you have questions for William McKeever, 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So tell me about Jaws, the movie, and Shark Week on the Discovery Channel. How does someone like you react to how those presentations influenced our perception of sharks?
Yeah. Well, Steve, my blood pressure just went up.
I was
when I hear
guess
the word
that.
Jaws,
yes.
And not because of you.
Yeah.
These are all great questions.
Right.
Jaws, that movie should be banned. It shouldn't be allowed on television. It is irresponsible. It sends out the completely the wrong message. And Peter Benchley, who wrote, obviously, the novel, realized what he had done mm-hmm. when he finished that book. So he spent the rest of his life trying to undo the myth that Jaws created. And his wife continues, even though Peter Benchley is dead. And so I'm on a mission to make people just, when Jaws comes on the TV, turn it off. It's just junk. There is this myth created by Jaws that sharks are out there and they're looking for us. They're hunting us. Mm-hmm. That is utterly not true.
I think people are going to be astonished when they hear that stat I threw out at the beginning of the show, that just 4 people on the planet were killed by sharks last year. I think people think it's hundreds and maybe thousands.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it all goes back to the movies and when the media talks about there's been a so-called attack. What's even more surprising, Steve, is that in this country where there are actually more shark attacks in the United States than any other country on the planet. And the reason is very simple. We are a wealthy country, and so people can go to the beach. And when they go to the beach, they're in the water, there's a chance for an encounter with a shark. So we have, 3 million surfers and probably over, I'm just going to guess, over 100 million people going to the beach on summer vacations. Mm-hmm. The fact is that there are only, historically, 50 to 55 so-called bites a year. Just shows you right there that if the sharks were really after us, it would be a bloodbath out there. Mm-hmm. And they're not. I have my film, Emperors of the Deep, I have a clip. And this gentleman was in Hawaii, and he set his drone out, and he was just kind of watching, and he saw a tiger shark. And it was swimming in maybe 3-4 feet of water, 10 yards off the beach. And the shark was meandering in between all these swimmers. Mm-hmm. And here they were. They didn't even know the shark was there. It's very hard to see them underwater. Sharks, mm-hmm. they can see us. We can't see them. And just another example of he's looking for fish. That's on his menu, not people.
Well, what do you think of Shark Week on the Discovery Channel? That gets a lot of attention each year.
Yeah, I have mixed emotions. You mm-hmm. know, sometimes they'll put something on that's responsible, educational, where we learn something about sharks and how remarkable they are, how they travel these hundreds of thousands of miles throughout their lifetime and dive to great depths. And people, I think, need to know that. But then there's still that other part that they still slip over into this idea of sharks, the dangerous man-eaters, mm-hmm. you know, and they'll talk about some theory why all the shark attacks are happening. And it's nothing more simple than a mistake on the part of the shark. They are out there hunting for prey, trying to make a living like we all are. And on a dark day and where the water visibility isn't good, if they see a surfboard, they might confuse that for a seal. Mm-hmm. They're an ordinary prey item. So these shows that they have where they talk about theories of why these big attacks are, that to me is irresponsible. Yeah. They're not helping the situation.
You know, they're
actually taking away from people's enjoyment.
Right.
One of the things I get excited about with this book is to say to people, look, go out, enjoy that ocean. It's so magnificent. It's a great vacation. You shouldn't be wasting any time thinking about a shark.
You know, you have this film, you've mentioned it a couple times, coming out next year. It's also titled Emperors of the Deep, in which you're seen actually swimming with sharks. And a lot of people have seen footage of that kind of thing before. But still, that strikes me as pretty scary because like any wild animal, you never know when a shark could turn on you. Or am I wrong about that, William?
Yeah, I think that's responsible, Steve, that you know, I think when we go out in the ocean, I don't want to leave the impression that these are shark and cuddlies animals and they're like dolphins. We can develop a relationship with them. They are wild animals. They're mm-hmm. apex predators. We need to respect them, give them their space. And if we do that, they will leave us alone because they're not interested in us. They have a real job to do. They have to fight for their survival every day. It's tough being an apex predator. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that if we get this view that we go into the ocean and we're careful and, you know, don't kick and make a lot of noise and commotion, we'll just be fine.
Mm-hmm. What's it like to swim with them?
It is a thrill. And I have to confess that when I first saw Jaws, it did leave an impression on me. And,
how can it not? Yeah. Yeah.
I have to admit, I was very afraid when I walked into, I went into a cage dive with great whites in South Africa. And, but that fear disappeared immediately because I could tell that shark was not interested in me. It was interested in these tuna heads that we had outside the cage to get his attention. And so that got me thinking. And then I had another dive in the Bahamas with sharks. And again, the same thing happened. They're swimming around me and others, and nothing's happening. And then finally, I was in Florida in an open water dive. I was literally on the surface, and some bull sharks showed up. And they looked at me, and I looked at them, and we're all respectful to each other. Very clear water, so they could tell, you know, I'm not a prey item. And, again, it was totally safe. So I wouldn't, again, just be with a great white or a tiger shark. Again, be respectful. Don't rush up to them. Just get out of the water if they are there. But if you do encounter one, just be mindful. Don't panic. Get out of the water. And, again, you'll be fine.
What do you pick up being so close to them? Anything? Was there anything you walked away with that maybe you didn't have before?
I think that they're very intelligent. They're not brash. They're actually very cautious, and they're curious animals. Tiger sharks can actually be somewhat playful. They will when they know divers are around. They will actually sneak up on them, almost as if to say, "Gotcha! You know, I fooled you." and some divers will pet the tiger shark's nose, and when they do that, it puts them into a kind of a trance. It's called tonic immobility. It's in my book, and they can flip the shark over and again do these things. This is the kind of thing that an ordinary swimmer you're not going to do. But again, it just shows that these are not animals that are crazed. They're smart. You know, we had cameras with us, and they went up to the camera and they're attracted to the electricity. And, they don't have hands like we do. So what they do is taste with their mouth. So, they nipped it. But it was all just to get information. It wasn't an attack bite. And, again, that showed me this curiosity, inquisitiveness, this caution.
I was going to say.
Which shows these are smart.
How else are they smart? How else do we know that they're smart? Because you talk about that, their intelligence. And I'm just curious, how does that manifest itself?
Yeah, well, I do have a chapter in the book about social lives of sharks and lemon sharks. And these sharks travel in groups in the Bahamas, these lemon sharks. They form friendships. They last. They can last for years. So they're showing some intelligence there to have a contact with another shark where they'll learn from that other shark how to hunt, absorb that information, and then be able to develop a relationship with other sharks.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because I always thought of sharks as such loners. You always see them on TV as, by themselves, traveling miles on their own.
Yeah, and that was a shock to me when I read this study that had been done at the University of Miami in the Bahamas. And Trustin Goodrich, the name of the scientist, spent several years in the Bahamas watching them, and he recorded all these activities. So when, for example, in the mangroves, when it's high tide and some predators can come in and eat sharks, because sometimes sharks are vulnerable, these sharks would pair up in groups and travel and hide together. And then when the tide would go out and it was safe, they would come out. and they would begin be with their friend. And what's interesting too is that they can travel great distances. And there was one great white shark that was tagged in South Africa, and he went to Australia and back in virtually a straight line. Hmm. And he did it in under 9 months. Now, that's one of the longest migrations on the planet. And so it shows a great deal of intelligence being able to make that kind of a maneuver in a straight line. Whether they're using the magnetic field, whether they're using the stars, some combination, that shows real ability. Wow. I know if I try to go from Australia to South Africa, I'd get lost.
Yeah. William McKeever is my guest. He's the author of Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. Dave from Lawrence asks, do they eat lionfish, William?
Lionfish are sadly so well protected with their spines that sharks will not eat lionfish.
Hmm.
And this is a problem for the Caribbean, and I know many people are experimenting with special traps to catch lionfish, but sharks will hunt stingrays, and sometimes they'll get a barb in their mouth, but lionfish are just too dangerous for them.
You mentioned this electroreception capability that sharks have. What is electroreception, and how effective is it?
Yeah, so they have these pits on their noses, and their little canals filled with fluid, and they can sense electrical signals. Now, every living creature that goes in the ocean sends out an electrical pulse, if you will, a message, and they can pick that up. The ability for them to pick up these electrical signals is incredibly sensitive.
Hmm.
And where they've developed this capability over millions of years.
Right, right.
And so when they hunt and they are looking to catch that seal, that last minute, they make that bite based on the electrical signals from that seal.
That's interesting.
And obviously, being great hunters, it's crucial for them.
I got about 30 seconds left. What needs to better protect sharks? What do you want to see happen, William?
Well, what I want to see happen is I think in this country we do a reasonably good job, but we still need to pass legislation that bans the trading of shark fins. Amazingly, you can trade shark fins legally in this country.
Hmm.
That's got to change. There are two bills in Congress, one in the Senate, one in the House. They should be passed. Number two is that we need to set up marine protected areas around the world where sharks are safe and where mm-hmm. they can grow and multiply. Right now, only 3% of the oceans are in marine protected areas. We need 40%
wow.
of the oceans in marine protected areas. And again, that's something with the, you know, people have more power than they realize.
Right.
You go into your elected representative and say, this is what we need. We can do this. It can't change.
William McKeever's new book, Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. He's got a film coming out next year by the same name. He'll be speaking at Linda Hall Library, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. More information, rainydaybooks.com. William, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve. It's a great pleasure to be here. Look forward to speaking to you again at some point in the future.
You bet. Join us on Friday as we talk with Kansas City manager Troy Schulte, who's retiring from office. Find out what he's learned managing Missouri's largest city and where he'll focus as he concludes his time in office. That's Troy Schulte Friday on KCUR's Up to Date. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.